And our next case this morning is Mart v. Gozdecki, case number 12-3801. Mr. Kennedy.
May it please the Court, my name is Stephen Kennedy, representing the appellant, Brad Mart. We have before us today a malpractice case with a Sarbanes-Oxley twist. It was dismissed following a Rule 12b-6 motion. The definitive question here involves whether the complaint alleged sufficient facts under three controlling cases, including Iqbal Twombly and this court's Hepperman versus Bass case. The estate of Davis is also helpful, but the key case from this circuit is Hepperman versus Bass. What we are asking this court to do is to apply the Hepperman case and reverse the district court's decision, which seems to have adopted state court pleading requirements for a federal diversity case. Now, the defense wants to treat the case as a summary judgment case, saying that Mart has to prove he will be successful in the Sarbanes-Oxley suit in his malpractice complaint. Hepperman already decided that issue and went the other way. Applying Hepperman versus Bass, as well as Iqbal Twombly in Rule 8, we apply Illinois substantive law here on whether or not the Gozdecki law firm, GDAF, committed malpractice. Was there an attorney-client relationship?
In the interest of time, I don't see this as a pleadings standard case or whether the pleadings were sufficient. I see this as a case raising a legal issue about the Dodd-Frank amendment to Sarbanes-Oxley and its retroactive effect, whether it was a clarifying amendment, because I think everybody agrees that if it was, and if the Dodd-Frank amendment to Sarbanes-Oxley's whistleblower provision applies here, then there's a claim.
Well, that would be a very wonderful result. However, I think there's one step in between that link, Your Honor, that must also be considered. The other side takes the position that we did not claim an agency relationship existed.
That's a separate way of getting in the door, as I see it, and as I understand what the parties agree on. The parties agree that there's two ways to get in the malpractice door here. In other words, that there would have been a meritorious claim. One is through the Dodd-Frank amendment to Sarbanes-Oxley, which, if it applies, Mart was an employee of a subsidiary of a publicly traded company, right? And so that's one way in which he would have had a claim, and the other way he has a claim is if under some construction of the agency language in the unamended Sarbanes-Oxley whistleblower provision, the subsidiary was an agent.
That assumes, Your Honor, that we must allege all of the Sarbanes-Oxley provisions in a complaint alleging malpractice. If we must allege in a malpractice case, the case within a case, so we allege all of the malpractice elements and then say, okay, here's why he qualifies under Sarbanes-Oxley. Either he was an employee of the publicly traded company, or he was an employee of an agent or of a publicly traded company. If we have to drill that deep in the pleadings, then yes, you're right. We have to address those issues. But if we do not have to drill that deep in the pleadings, then we never get to those issues because the district court judge has to decide, was there enough control over my client based on the discovery? Was there an agency relationship based on the discovery? So it really hinges. I mean, you're right
there. There's a threshold legal issue on both of those avenues into a malpractice claim, right? and regardless of what the discovery might show about agency, et cetera, there's a threshold legal issue to be decided that determines the viability of the malpractice claim, the case within a case.
Right. So could I allege that my client was an employee of Berkshire Hathaway? Would you then
if that's legally impossible, then the case was properly dismissed. So it all depends on what the proper interpretation of the statutory scheme is.
Well,
it either applies or it doesn't apply, you know, based on the accepted as true factual allegations of the complaint.
Well, I think I addressed that specifically in the reply, but let's go ahead and take that head on. Under the Sarbanes-Oxley statute, which was enacted in 2002, there is a section heading. And that section heading reads, quote, A, whistleblower protection for employees of publicly traded companies, unquote. There are several cases that hold that very section heading means that no employee of any other entity, whether you're a subcontractor, a contractor, or an agent, can ever, ever assert a Whistleblower Protection Act case. Then we have Dodd-Frank. It amends the statute. But I ask you, did the Dodd-Frank amendment amend or do anything with respect to that section heading? If this section heading controls the entire statute, why didn't Dodd-Frank take out two words from that section heading? They left the section heading in the statute. Reading this, you have a slippery slope. If this section heading, whistleblower protection for employees of publicly traded companies, limits the entire statute to just employees of publicly traded companies, then Dodd-Frank accomplished nothing when it added several words to the middle of the statute, because the two are conflicting.
Presumably ratings firms can't fire employees of their publicly traded clients, right?
Correct.
Thank you.
So surely that's not what they intended, and this is what the dissent in Lawson points out. It came before. It came after Dodd-Frank. The dissent does a much more articulate job than I have in explaining exactly why Sarbanes-Oxley, in its original form, should have been interpreted to mean that when you are an employee of a subcontractor, an agent, or some other entity, you still have the ability to assert a Sarbanes-Oxley cause of action.
We don't have to disagree with Lawson, which is now up on cert, but we don't have to disagree with that to find a viable claim under the amended
Sox,
right?
Okay. That is correct.
Okay.
You can, because there are significant differences between the First Circuit's decision in Lawson and here, based on the facts, and it's also
That had to do with contractors, not subsidiaries, right?
That's correct.
Okay.
I would point out that in Lawson, in a somewhat confusing area of the majority's opinion, Lawson actually says that Dodd-Frank was clarifying. And it sort of comes out of nowhere. They state that it's a clarifying statute, and I quote that on page 25 in my opening brief. Towards the end, I specifically have the statement in there. Actually, it's on page 26. Implicit in the core summary of these amendments is the idea that while Section 806 needed to be expanded to include employees of rating agencies, Congress only needed to clarify that the provision always included employees of subsidiaries, which seems inconsistent with what the majority says in other sections. But nevertheless, that supports the provision that it was a clarifying statute.
And, in fact, that's the position of the Department of Labor in the Johnson case.
Yes.
And if we accept that or defer to it under Chevron, then there's a claim here.
Yes.
regardless of how the Supreme Court decides Lawson and the contractor agency issue. I mean, it's a separate.
Correct.
As I said, it's a separate
yes.
basis on which your client has a malpractice claim here.
Yes, I do not believe the Supreme Court will hear that issue specifically that we have before you. So. So
maybe we should focus on that and whether the Johnson case is entitled to Chevron deference so that we don't work at cross purposes with the Supreme Court since we don't know what it's going to do.
Correct. I agree with that completely. And with respect to Chevron deference, I mean, surely we have a situation where we have the Department of Labor issuing a decision in Johnson, and the Department of Labor made it quite clear that the statute was should be read, first of all, Sarbanes-Oxley should be read, first of all, to cover employees of subsidiaries. And in any event, Sarbanes-Oxley should be construed to have been clarified and not substantively amended by Dodd-Frank. And therefore, applying the Chevron doctrine to our specific case, there should be no issue that the district court did erred in its conclusion in dismissing my client's Rule 12b-6 case. If there are no further questions, I'll reserve my remaining time.
That's fine. Mr. Sullivan.
Good morning. Peter Sullivan for the defendant law firm. This court should affirm the district court's dismissal of this case because Section 806 of Sarbanes-Oxley, as initially enacted, applies only to employees of publicly traded companies, and it does not apply to private companies. That is the essential issue in this case, and I understand your honors have made it clear that you want to address the deference issue as well, and I will address that. But I do want to begin with the complaint in this case, which alleged two undisputed facts, that Forest River is not a publicly traded company. It's a private company that's owned by Berkshire, and Berkshire is the publicly traded company, and repeatedly alleged that Mr. Mart was an employee of Forest River, not Berkshire. Those allegations are the ones that are most critical in this case because they establish that there was no SOX claim under Section 806 unless you interpret that SOX statute as applying to employees of private companies, which it doesn't.
Employees of subsidiaries of public companies.
Who have
a subsidiary
whose financial statements are consolidated with the parent.
I accept that as a fact, but that's not what it said in Section 806 of Sarbanes-Oxley. That's what it said in Dodd-Frank, which was enacted in 2010 after the acts that give rise to this case.
Can I ask you a question, Mr. Sullivan? One of the concerns in dealing with arguably retroactive application of statutory amendments is interference with reliance interests. Do you think there are reliance interests at work here so that executives and their attorneys were saying before Dodd-Frank was enacted, Sarbanes-Oxley is not going to stop us from firing this whistleblower because he works for one of our subsidiaries rather than for an unincorporated division?
I'm sure it may be an issue in some corporations. In this one, I highly doubt it because we strenuously dispute with the concept that Berkshire is the entity that made the decision to discharge Mr. Mart. It's our position that decision was made by Forest River and not by Berkshire. But I'm outside the pleadings now, and I understand that. So
I'm just trying. Can you imagine a lawyer giving an executive that advice? This whistleblower can be fired because he works for the unincorporated division rather than one of our, or because he works for the subsidiary rather than one of our divisions?
I don't know that a lawyer would give that advice. I think a lawyer might be asked to advise whether if this person who might allege to be a whistleblower is fired, will it give rise to a SOX claim a lawyer might advise whether it would or would not give rise to a SOX claim. But even if it doesn't give rise to a SOX claim, it could give rise to all other kinds of common law claims. Mm-hmm. And, of course, there were other common law claims asserted in the underlying case in Indiana in this case.
One of the problems we need to deal with on this question of whether Dodd-Frank was clarifying or a substantive amendment is, in essence, how reasonable an interpretation this was of the original language.
Right.
And can you think of any policy reasons why the authors of Sarbanes-Oxley would have drawn a line between whistleblowers in subsidiaries and those in unincorporated divisions of the same company?
I can. Why is it that Sarbanes-Oxley, and by the way, the Forest River Company was, as I understand it, acquired by Berkshire after Sarbanes-Oxley was enacted in 2002. I think the allegation is that it was acquired in 2005, if I'm not mistaken. Suddenly, an investment holding company, Berkshire Hathaway, which has its own employees, makes an investment and acquires this subsidiary that operates independently called Forest River in Indiana, involved in a motorhome business, manufacturing business. Why is it that all of a sudden the 100 or whatever number of employees that Forest River has suddenly become swept into the SOX statute that's supposed to apply to employees of publicly traded companies just by the unfortunate occurrence that a publicly traded company such as Berkshire happens to acquire them? I could absolutely see Congress drawing the line in that
why?
Kind of a situation.
Why? I still haven't heard why they might want to.
Well, because why would employees of a small private subsidiary of a massive publicly traded company that's merely investing in other companies be dragged into the net of Sarbanes-Oxley?
You just described the situation. You haven't given us a reason.
Well, I suppose you are now exposing every single private company and giving to Sarbanes-Oxley problems and giving public companies an incentive
only ones that are held by publicly traded companies. I mean, Sarbanes-Oxley was about investor protection, right, in the wake of Enron.
Yes, it was. But it also made a clear distinction between private companies and public companies.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody's contending here that Sarbanes-Oxley should apply to every private company in the United States.
Right.
In fact, that was one of the significant concerns that were discussed when the statute was enacted, when SOX was enacted, that it was not to apply to every single private company in the United States.
And nobody here is suggesting that it did or that it does now, at least this provision. So, but if you're concerned, in essence, about whistleblowers with material information for investors in the publicly traded company, why would you want to distinguish in the protection you give to those who are directly employed by the publicly traded company and those employed by their subsidiaries?
I think Congress had to draw the line somewhere. It would have been easy enough for Congress to simply use the word subsidiaries when they enacted SOX or subsidiaries and affiliates. They didn't. They didn't use it in the text of the statute. They didn't use it in the caption that is immediately preceding the text. We're not talking about a caption seven paragraphs away. We're talking about the caption immediately above the text. They didn't do it in the title of Section 806. And if you look at the Sarbanes-Oxley statute, it's many, many, many pages long. Well, 806 is one particular section contained on one page. And both the title and the caption are right on that page. And both of them say employees of publicly traded companies. So
by my count,
to take that interpretation.
By my count, Judge Sykes and I have now asked you three times for a policy reason. I haven't heard one, but I won't belabor the point if that's your answer.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that Congress can draw the line wherever they want to draw the line, and it's not this Court's position to expand the line that Congress drew when the legislative text is clear on the point.
Well, this gets to the clarification question about Dodd-Frank's or this aspect of Dodd-Frank as it pertains to Sarbanes-Oxley. And so Congress has now clarified, at least according to the Department of Labor, which considers it to be a clarifying amendment, clarified that it did indeed mean subsidiaries. In the definition of, or when it used the word company in the underlying Sarbanes-Oxley whistleblower protection statute. So now we know, so why shouldn't we give deference to...
Retroactivity and clarification are related, because
Well, if it's a clarifying amendment, that overcomes the presumption of anti-retroactivity.
Sure, but we should first note that there is a presumption of anti-retroactivity.
Right, and let's take that as a given. So.
And secondly, we should note that there is no explicit statement by Congress in the Dodd-Frank statute that it is a clarifying as opposed to a non-clarifying
amendment. And the Department of Labor acknowledged that and moved on to the next part of the analysis.
I will. But I first want to point out the Middleton case, which came from the Seventh Circuit, which also cites the Brown v. Thompson case from the Fourth Circuit, where the court said that in order to have a clarifying amendment, it needs to be stated explicitly in the amendment itself. That it was Congress's intent to clarify and not to amend. And there is no such statement. And
so
Congress knows...
you want us to follow the Fourth Circuit rather than the Middleton test?
No, the Middleton test followed the Brown v. Thompson case. Cited the Brown v. Thompson case.
Cited it, but also looked at a number of factors beyond just the
test. Okay, and then also... I'm sorry. You're right. And also cited a number of factors that should be considered. And also quoted, I believe there's a quote from Middleton that said, where they relied on this one word, losing party in Middleton relied on one word from a Senate report, the word clarify, which is the only word that is relied upon in any legislative history to support that Dodd-Frank was a clarifying amendment. And this court said in Middleton that we're hesitant in this case to afford a single word more than it deserves, which is, you can't rely on the word clarify in a Senate report. You need to rely on some language in the amendment itself that clarifies it. Also, the principle of retroactivity isn't supposed to apply when it increases a party's liability for past conduct, or when it imposes new duties with respect to transactions that have already been completed. And that's the Landgraf and Killingsworth line of cases, and also Middleton. And that's exactly what you would be doing here if you ruled that this was a clarifying amendment. You would be increasing the Berkshire's and our Forest River's liability for past conduct and imposing new duties. And the question was asked to opposing counsel whether you have to disagree with Lawson in order to reverse here. And I would respectfully submit you absolutely do have to disagree with Lawson in order to reverse here.
Lawson didn't specifically address the subsidiary question or whether the Dodd-Frank amendment was clarifying or not.
It didn't address the Dodd-Frank issue. It didn't address the subsidiary issue. But it did hold, in reviewing the text of 806, that only employees of publicly traded companies were
right, and the question subject. Here is what is encompassed within the word company in the Sarbanes-Oxley whistleblower provision, either standing alone or as amended by Dodd-Frank, and if we're giving effect to the amendment, whether that's impermissibly retroactive or not, depending on whether it's merely a clarifying amendment.
The other question I want to point out on the extent to which you should give Chevron deference, and this is an important point in analyzing that issue, the Department of Labor was never given any rulemaking authority with respect to interpreting Section 806 of SOX. It was given partial adjudicative authority. It was not even given exclusive adjudicative authority. The adjudicative authority is overlapping. You can bring a claim administratively. You can bring a claim in court. You can appeal the administrative ruling. So the Department of Labor in the Lawson cert petition briefing admitted that no Chevron deference would apply and hasn't taken a position to the contrary. And part of the reason for that is that no rulemaking or substantive interpretation authority was given to the Department of Labor. That was left to the courts to decide.
I haven't taken a look at that briefing. Is there discussion of Meade deference or anything else, or just Skidmore, or what?
There is discussion of whether Chevron deference should apply. There is discussion.
The DOL says no.
I'm sorry?
If DOL says we don't want Chevron deference, that's a pretty powerful argument.
That's what DOL said.
Did they say anything about Mead or Skidmore?
No. They did not argue Skidmore deference. They did not argue Chevron deference. They argued remedial purposes of SOX. That's what they argued. And there is a subsequent...
Did the Department of Labor disclaim the idea of any deference at all?
They didn't rely on deference. They relied on other arguments.
What you're telling us is two different things here.
I'm sorry if I'm confusing.
Yeah.
It also would be astonishing if the government didn't want any deference at all from its agency.
They obviously made an argument.
Okay.
Well, and perhaps it's because there wasn't an agency interpretation of the precise issue that's before the court in Lawson, right? And there is on the subsidiary issue that's before us.
I'm sorry, I didn't interrupt. There's a subsequent decision, the Johnson decision from the ARB is one that you've noted. Then came Lawson, and there's another ARB decision called Spinner, S-P-I-N-N-E-R. And the Spinner case discusses Lawson and respectfully disagrees with Lawson, but doesn't disagree on the basis that deference should have been given under Chevron or Skidmore. Disagrees based on interpretation of the language in the statute.
Right, but that's because there was no agency interpretation at the time the Court of Appeals decided Lawson. Is that maybe?
Well, there actually is. There actually is a DOL administrative regulation that purports to define the word employee in Section 806 of SOX. And that definition was pointed out, but it was not argued that there should be Chevron or Skidmore deference to that regulatory definition of employee because the regulatory scheme was for procedural purposes only. It was not for substantive rulemaking. And no deference should be applied when it's not substantive rulemaking. That was not the authority that was given to the Department of Labor. And deference, you have an issue that you'd first have to, I think, conclude that disagree with Lawson, that the word employee means employee of publicly traded companies in order to grant that deference. Because if you follow Lawson, which has six different rationales for why it reached the conclusion, and they are extensive, well-written rationales, then you must conclude that employee means employee of publicly traded companies only, and then it's clearly not a clarifying amendment. It changed the law, which is our position. Dodd-Frank 929 changed the law to include not only subsidiaries, but also affiliates, and then also rating agencies, all three. For all of those reasons, we would respectfully request that the district court's decision be affirmed.
Thank you. Mr. Kennedy, you have 4 minutes remaining.
I respectfully disagree with the defense argument's interpretation of Johnson with respect to how the DOL presented the decision with respect to Chevron deference. And I think that opinion is very long and it's dense. However, it does include a statement. All of the elements that are presented in a Chevron deference matter. Now, when you read the opinion, you certainly come away with the conclusion that they're saying there is Chevron deference. And that is the conclusion that the Leshinsky case out of the Southern District of New York concluded, reading that case. So it seems as if the other judges who have read that have interpreted it to mean that they are providing Chevron deference.
Judge Etkin read it that way. Judge Darrow read it differently. I'm not sure that we owe Chevron deference to an agency's interpretation of whether it is entitled to Chevron deference. That gets to be a little too much of a game of mirrors.
it does. However, I think we can avoid that game of mirrors because the Department of Labor did, in fact, define the word employee And they defined the word employee in its regulations. And under that definition of employee, it is absolutely consistent with what Leshinsky interprets the employee to mean and what the dissent in Lawson says. So I don't think it's a fair statement to just sort of sweep under the rug that definition of employee that the Department of Labor has given for that word for all of Sarbanes-Oxley. In conclusion, I would request that this court reverse the district court's decision and for the reasons that we've discussed today and remand it for further proceedings. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Our thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.